Good morning. The House Transportation Committee will come to order today, May 3rd, 1999. Our first bill up on the agenda is Senate Joint Memorial 4, and we have Robert Lowry signed up to testify. Please come forward, Mr. Lowry. Oh, I'll open the public hearing.
Thank you, Chair and Representative Walker and members of the committee. I am thankful for this opportunity to come before you this morning and appreciate your willingness to hear me out. I'm speaking in support of the memorial, and as I pointed out on the sheet that's been given to you, I frequently use the Pioneer on business trips, and I found it convenient to finish my work on presentations that I was going to do on the train. There was no phone, there was no other interruption. So personally, it was a very useful thing for me in my work. At those times, I noticed the large numbers of cut flowers along with other items that were coming from Oregon and the Northwest being unloaded in places like Salt Lake City and further points east. And so I see that it's important to businesses here in Oregon to have that facility available to them. And my understanding is that Amtrak is very concerned about the development of express traffic for the Pioneer. And so I would just add my support for that thought. I appreciate in the joint memorial your comments on the need of many Eastern Oregonians for the Amtrak service of the Pioneer, both those that are elderly and handicapped, and I would point out that Amtrak is totally handicap accessible, and also the matter of in midwinter when that's sometimes the only thing moving. And I recall reading many times of people getting picked up off I-84 by the Pioneer in order to get out of the gorge.
One thing that I noticed in studying the Pioneer is that the people in Eastern Oregon use it at a far higher percentage than the rest of the state. If you look at it from a population basis, that their ridership was anywhere from 2 to 3 times what you would have anticipated at looking at riderships elsewhere in the state. And so my analysis then is that they do want to use it, they do have a need for it, and I think we need to support them in that. Another point is that when I was working with a nonprofit museum group, we were making plans to use the Pioneer to take a tour group to Baker City and spend several days there and then return on. That fell through when the Pioneer went to less than daily service. Unfortunately, the museum group I'm working with has been closed down, so I can't do that, but there's certainly other groups, including the Oregon Historical Society, for example, that has doing much more tours now. And so I think there's the potential there not only for museum groups, but for private tour operators to use the Pioneer to access Baker City and other historical sites in Eastern Oregon. The last point that I would like to emphasize is that we have two huge metropolitan areas that are both developing as corridors with their own transportation, local transportation programs. The Cascadia Corridor here in the Northwest, and the Salt Lake Valley, which is now beginning to set up its own rail corridor service and light rail service because of the population growth, the pressures on the highway system, and this is a lot cheaper way to go. And so the Pioneer would connect these two major corridor areas. And I think I'll stop at that and be open to questions.
Any more questions?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Wells.
Thank you. I'm always a little bit in a quandary when I get set on a committee and deal with these type of issues where we're acting Congress to make decisions. And my quandary always is should we as a committee go into any detail, so to speak, on what were the economic issues, what were the social issues, so to speak, of the particular thing that's in front of us. And, you know, not knowing why that train has not continued to operate, or knowing the economic issues and that sort of thing, it's, maybe we're not supposed to deal with those. Maybe we're just supposed to ask them to go ahead and start running it. How do we make a decision whether this is a good issue we should be involved in?
Well, my understanding is Amtrak would not start up the service unless they felt they could sustain it from income from express and passengers. That's my understanding. In other words, my understanding is that this is an exploratory time for them. They think seriously about doing it, but what I perceive is that I want to see support from the state saying, we would like to have it, but my understanding also is that if they don't feel it's going to fly, they're not going to do it.
I guess, Madam Chair, that's where I'm in the quandary. Should I ask them to be doing something that's it's purely not economical viable, that needs a higher level subsidy than it receives in other areas of the country? Is that a good thing I should be asking them? On what basis should I make this decision?
My perception, and I may be wrong, but my perception is that they are looking at this to be relatively self-sustaining. Otherwise, they're not going to start it up.
Why did they stop in the first place?
Pardon?
Why did they discontinue this service?
Well, one thing was they were not handling much in the way of express. It was relatively light. The most I think I saw was two cars on the Pioneer, and I think they're looking in terms of maybe 10, 12, or more cars of express. And my understanding also is that they feel that this would then bring them into a break-even situation. I don't think they're going to start up unless they feel relatively confident that they will get enough express business to approach a break-even point at least.
And we'll think, well, I think ODOT will be taking on to be able to clear up some of those things for us. Any other questions from the committee? Well, Ms. Larry, I really appreciate you coming forward today. It's such a pleasure to have a citizen come in and testify. We hear from a lot of agencies and special interests, and your testimony is very informative. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we have Representative Jensen here.
Thank you, Chair Walker, and members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here this morning and have the opportunity to testify in relationship to SJM 4 and to urge your support for this measure. I have some testimony that's coming out for you, and I would pick up with that in pointing out that trains certainly are part of our national heritage, that they've long played a vital role in Oregon's economy, and that they figure to continue to play a vital role in our economy. Now, too, is a time when increased public transportation is being demanded by Oregonians. Trains diminish the congestion on our well-traveled roads. They also provide a very pleasant and much safer alternative during harsh winters when traveling through the Columbia River Gorge or over the Blue Mountains with winds, ice, rain, snow, make road transportation somewhat very difficult and precarious. And this is especially true for the senior and elders in our society. And I would point out to you that in my district, the train represented a vital means of transportation for people to get to the social and health services that they need. We do not have in Eastern Oregon, in the cow towns of Eastern Oregon, Madam Chair, all of the health care opportunities that those of you who are fortunate enough or unfortunate enough as the case may be, to live in the Willamette Valley. It's a long ways to hospitals, it's a long ways to professional services of this type, and senior citizens are tremendously handicapped when it comes to that, even if they're still able to drive in the winter through the gorge. It's a very difficult drive for them, and over the Blue Mountains it is equally difficult and problematic. Since Boise and Portland are two primary sources for those, the Amtrak was used by people in eastern Oregon for these purposes for some time. In relationship to this, I would simply conclude by asking you to seriously consider a favorable passage of this bill, to send a message on to Congress, and with that I will conclude and respond to any questions that you may have.
All right, thank you. Representative
Raymond. Representative, if we were to provide this means of transportation, won't that make it easier to breach the dams then, because we'll have alternative means for people to get off the highways there and get all those trucks coming down?
Well, I don't think that our seniors are going to make that much difference in the whole scheme of things, if that's the question, Representative.
Any other questions from the committee?
Just a comment that I'm a person who, thank you, Madam Chair, I'm a person who's ridden the Pioneer from Kelso to Boise, and it is a pleasant trip, particularly in February, because the route is beautiful along the river, and it's much more pleasant than driving in gorgeous to sit in the subcarms. A park all the way, so I probably have a conflict of interest, because it's disconcerting to me that just as I'm about ready to retire, that the possibility of going to Chicago by train is not available. it's a measure I can support.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Jensen, Amtrak asked Oregon for $2.9 million. What was the impedance to coming up with $3 million in a $9 billion budget? Do you know?
Madam Chair and Representative Crummell, I'm sorry I didn't sit on the committee that heard the last session.
Thank you.
Representative Jensen,
did
you have further comments?
No.
Okay, you started to say something.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, great. Thanks very much for coming. I enjoy hearing about those cow towns.
Thank you very kindly.
Next, we'll hear from ODOT. We have Claudia Howells with us today. Yes, I am. While she's coming forward, I just wanted to let the committee know that Senator Nelson, who sponsored this measure, wanted to be here this morning, so that I could give him a hard time as a chair. But he tried up in ways and means and couldn't make it. So, Ms. Howells, thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am Claudia Howells, manager of ODOT's Rail Division. ODOT supports passenger rail service and recognizes the need for transportation options for all Oregonians. We do not question at all that people once served by the Pioneer are now seriously disadvantaged. The difficulty is that Congress has directed Amtrak to become self-sufficient, actually by the year 2003, at least in terms of operating costs. The Pioneer was a high-cost, low-ridership train, and I'm talking about the route from Portland all the way to Chicago. Amtrak made the difficult decision to drop the Pioneer and return the Empire Builder to daily service, a decision that was made no doubt by the strength of ridership on the Empire Builder. And I might add that ridership on the Empire Builder, now that it is back to 7 days a week service, has actually begun to grow again.
Yes. Could you describe the Empire Builder as compared to the Pioneer?
The Empire Builder, Madam Chair, Representative Lehman, runs from Seattle to Portland, and then on the north side of the gorge, up through, eventually through Montana and then to Chicago. So the Pioneer, which ran south through Salt Lake City and then Denver, also ran to Chicago. But they both, at least from the standpoint of the Pacific Northwest, went from Pacific Northwest to Chicago.
Okay. So if I understand correctly, you can now, with the Empire Builder, you can now go Portland to Chicago. You still do that, but with the Pioneer, you can go Portland, Salt Lake City, Chicago, and it serves Eastern Oregon as compared to Eastern Washington.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Women, that's correct. In 1996, ridership on the Pioneer was 12th within Oregon, meaning origin destination within Oregon, was 12,362. The total ridership between Seattle, Portland, and Chicago was only 87,000, almost 88,000 in 1995. It is noteworthy, and I think a little sad, that other states along the route made no effort at all to save the service, making Oregon a lone voice as we and the Oregon congressional delegation fought to save the train. There is merit in looking at what the market potential is for express freight service, which Amtrak has agreed to do. They have some new rules now loosening the term of express freight after going through a rather lengthy and costly Surface Transportation Board process. I might add that the Union Pacific fought the effort of Amtrak to expand its express freight service. The revenue shortfall at the time service was discontinued was approximately $21 million annually for the entire corridor, with about a $5 million a year loss assigned to Oregon. I'm not sure the point that it came from. It may have been a number that Amtrak offered at the time. But $5 million was actually the revenue loss in between Portland and the Idaho border. Whether or not express mail or express freight can in fact make up the gap, I think remains to be seen. Certainly the potential is there, and Amtrak is looking at their whole system for increasing revenue generally. I can offer you some hope. Gil Carmichael, a very successful businessman from Meridian, Mississippi, and former administrator of the Federal Railroad Administration under Presidents Reagan and Bush, has become a vocal proponent of what he calls Stage 2. By the way, he makes his living as a car dealer, automobile, not rail car. He suggests that the country must rebuild its passenger and freight rail systems with the same fervor it spent on building the interstate highway network. As a board member of Delta Airlines, he recognizes that the airline industry and airports are at near capacity. He realizes, I think as many of us do, that he, from his perspective of being from the state of Mississippi, the vast reaches of this country are now entirely dependent on automobile for passenger transportation. And finally, he appreciates the demographics of this country, which strongly favors quality rail service as the population ages and, in fact, is as affluent as it ever has been. Mr. Carmichael is an influential man, and if he is successful, Congress may take a different view of Amtrak service and be willing to increase subsidy. There are many ideas being explored now by the Amtrak Reform Council, which Mr. Carmichael chairs, that we hope will offer ways to revive rail service where it has been lost. It's critical that Oregon continues to maintain and enhance the rail service we have. There are now many parts of the state interested in passenger rail. We are working with many communities to look at that as an option. But we cannot maintain that service or even look forward if we don't keep the service we have, the backbone of our service, which is within the Willamette Valley. We would like nothing better than for the Pioneer to return, but it will never stand on its own. The Pioneer, to be economically viable, must be part of a greater rail network, and I speak nationally, not just in the state, and connect with communities all the way between here and Chicago. ODOT will continue to offer any assistance we can. Thank you.
Thank you. Question, Representative Cremel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Howell, did the Empire Builder start actually coming down through and going, taking the north side of the gorge after the Pioneer was dropped? Because I believe that it didn't it used to go across northern Washington from Seattle to Spokane and then through northern Idaho and into Montana?
Madam Chair, Representative Cromwell, the import border has always had somewhat of a forked route, and then it had one route out of Seattle to Spokane and another that went down to Portland and over the gorge, and then they actually meet and the trains come together in Spokane. That's been for a very long time.
Oh, it has. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Two questions, if I may. I'm not quite sure how Amtrak operates, but do they rent the tracks? Do they pay a fee to somebody for track rental?
Madam Chair, Representative Montgomery, yes, sir.
I'd follow up on that then, if I may. Do they pay the same as all the other railroads in the Hall of Freight?
Madam Chair, Representative Montgomery, those operating fees are negotiated, and then in fact the Surface Transportation Board has jurisdiction if there is a dispute. Amtrak recently has renegotiated most of its contracts with the freight carrier, which is actually the landlord. In this case, the Pioneer was basically renting time and space from Union Pacific, as in fact they do in the Atlantic Valley. Amtrak does own its part of its East Coast corridor, but the rest of it isn't. They're entirely dependent on the freight railroad.
If I may, the question was, do they pay the same rate as SP&S when they're using UP tracks?
Madam Chair, Representative Montgomery, no, sir.
They pay a higher rate, do they, Madam Chair?
Madam Chair, they pay a lower rate.
Lower rate, thank you. The other thing, if I may, to follow up on, I live on the railroad tracks. I live on the wrong side of the tracks. And one of the other problems was they ran right on time every day. We heard them go by sometime between 12 and 4 o'clock. That was some of their problems.
Thank you. Well.
Thank you. Following that, I think we need to understand that there's a train that comes out of San Francisco and goes to Salt Lake. It's a passenger train. Isn't that true?
Madam Chair, Representative Ellis, yes, sir.
So all we're talking about then would be Idaho and Oregon that's really being left out of this, because Utah does have service to Salt Lake City with passenger train service. So we really don't have very many other states that would be interested in helping us with this issue, unless people were in Utah necessarily wanting to travel to Portland, but as far as going back and forth from the coast to the east, there is a passenger train that meets in Salt Lake.
Madam Chair, Representative Wells, that's correct.
Okay.
Representative Lehman.
This may be an unfair question, but if I board the train in Portland, how long does it take me to get to Chicago as it stands now?
Madam Chair, Representative Lehman, based on my own experience on the Empire Builder, it's a little under 3 days, 2 overnights, arriving around noon on the third day.
Madam Chair, I've ridden it about 10 times. It takes 50 hours from Portland to Chicago.
Thank you. What the cost is for a ticket now to do that round trip?
Madam Chair, Representative Lehman, no, I don't. And it does vary. The Amtrak is now pricing somewhere like the airlines, where you get a discount if you buy a ticket, well in advance. And so there is quite a bit of variability.
Looks like the right side of our committee is pretty silent. I'm hearing anything coming. Any other questions? Okay, thank you, Ms. Howells. I appreciate you coming forward today. We also have Dave Barringer from the League of Oregon Cities.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dave Barenberg with the League of Oregon Cities, and just briefly, I wanted to voice the League's support for the resolution that during my session with this issue was heated up, and many cities in eastern Oregon really worked hard with especially members of the congressional delegation to try to keep this link to our system going. And a lot of the local mayors thought that this was really critical just for the community, I think as we discussed before, to have a link for those who aren't able to use cars, provide options for folks especially who are elderly, disabled, and need to link into medical services too in the valley, that there just aren't a lot of options, especially in the winter when it's tough going across the Blues and some of the other roadways. And it's also been clear through our whole membership of the league from one end of the state to the other that there's been support for, as there's been support for Valley communities and Southern Oregon communities for the Pioneer, there's been support from Eastern Oregon communities for the rail service in the Valley. I think it's really been an issue where folks have seen that there is a system in the state and that we really do need to work together to try to keep it functioning. And with that, I would just urge your passage and be happy to answer any questions. One other thing I would just add, it was really ironic. When they canceled the service, it was just about the day, the weekend after they were canceling the service, there was a feature piece on the front cover of the Sunday New York Times travel section about taking rail through and exploring Oregon, Eastern Oregon by rail. Beautiful color pictures and suggesting that it be something that people do at a time when the service was already going to have been canceled. Anyway, thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Any questions?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Welch.
Dave, do you think it's really kosher, or whatever the word is, that we should ask Congress to restore this service if we're not ourselves willing to put a little money or amount this, so to speak, and help subsidize this issue? I guess this is part of the issue. To send a memorial like this off to Congress, yeah, we're not willing to put any money up. Is that really the way we should be going?
Madam Chair, Representative Wells, I think that's an open question. I think in terms of, I think what the resolution does is gets Oregon on record as saying this is something important. I don't know that this outcome would ever be Amtrak would set step up with 100%. I think the hope would be that there would be some continuing discussions to try to restore this that would involve some commitment of resources from Amtrak, exploring some of the things that Natal testified about in terms of reducing costs by doing more express mail and other services, increasing ridership, and maybe involving additional state participation, as there is discussion now for some additional rail service funding for the Valley to make that or continue that as a viable service and expand it to serve more state needs. So there might be a point where there'd be a discussion of some level of state subsidy too. But I think that, you know, the idea is to just get this back on the table and just see if we can put together some plan to make it work.
Thank you. Any further questions?
Madam Chair,
yes, welcome.
I'm not sure that I should ask this question today, but I will, because you're the one that's there. In your opinion, obviously the state is going to be expected to put up some money, and I am wondering if there's been any discussion at all as to how much that might be and what kind of ridership they're going to expect from this.
Madam Chair, Representative Logan, frankly, I'm rusty on that. All the numbers that were in my head when this discussion really was on the front burner during the last session, as this issue was progressing, have sort of left my head as after it went. But I know that there were a number of different plans and looks to try to reduce the cost of the service, you know, doing some of the more innovative marketing and other things. But I don't remember, and Ms. Howes may have a better recollection than I do.
Thank you.
Would you like to bring her back up and answer?
I think that would be good.
All right. Thank you. Ms. Bamberg, Ms. Howe, would you come back up here and answer that question for us, please?
Madam Chair, Representative Loken, 3 years ago we just talked to Amtrak about what kind of options were out there. We really never got to the point of coming down to a dollar figure. We can certainly go back and do that. There is somewhat of a difficult issue here, and this is a train service that went to Chicago. So there was actually a request to all of the states along the route whether they were willing to come up with some financial backing. And the only one that showed any remote interest at all at that time was Oregon. And Oregon was the only one that even kind of answered the phone. The rest of the states simply walked away from it. So that leaves a big question about where you want the rail service to go. If it would be a standalone, as an example, to Boise, the economics would be very different than all the way to Chicago. As I said, we can certainly go back and have those discussions again with Amtrak, factor in the economic potential for express rail and or express freight, and see where we go from there.
Any further questions?
I guess my concern would be that we're asking for Congress to bless us, but we don't know if we're going to respond if they do bless. And I haven't seen, you know, a great surge of interest. We're having a hard time to think about rail at all in this state. So, without knowing a little more of the financial information, I would be hard put to sponsor this resolution or to support it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. House, in your testimony you said that in 1996 ridership in Oregon on the Pioneer was 12,362. Is that for the whole year?
Madam Chair, Representative Kummel, and yes, sir, that's origin and destination within Oregon. We had attempted to isolate the Oregon ridership, in other words, points between Portland all the way to Ontario. Yes, sir.
Thank you.
And his service was only it was not a 7-day-a-week service in 96, was it?
Madam Chair, Representative Taylor, yes, it was 3 days a week. And one thing that is important is when they went from 7 days a week to three, there was a significant decrease in ridership, not more than what you would expect from just dropping the trains, because at that point it was very difficult to ride.
Representative Montgomery?
This comment, I guess, I'll support this resolution, but for the benefit of the committee, if you're led to believe that it stops in Eastern Oregon, it does not stop in Cascade Lock. It does not stop in a lot of the small towns. So the ridership is from the big cities like Hood River, so it's not the small towns that are affected. We already get there for now.
Thank you. I don't have anyone else signed up to testify today. Did anyone come in and not just sign up? All right, then I'll close the public hearing and we'll have a work session on SJM 4. What's the pleasure of the committee, Representative Hill?
Madam Chair, move Regent Memorial 4 to the floor with the dispatcher foundation.
Okay. Representative Hill has moved SJM 4 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Representative Krupp.
Thank you. For the record, I will vote for this because I think we need to continue to look at alternative modes of transportation that have previously existed and that could, in my view, be economically feasible once again. And I qualify that statement because I believe that Amtrak in itself, in terms of its operation, is one of the most inefficient organizations that's ever existed under the office of the United States government. And it has to do some very, very serious reforming to make it what I would consider to be an effective business. Congress is moving in the right direction. I applaud them for that. I think it's a brilliant idea to try to include certain types of freight with this particular train. I think if we're going to have efficient rail travel in the future, it has to be run more efficiently. It has to be more attractive in the marketplace, offer better timing, better services to get people out of their cars if they want to get out of their cars, and get people out of airplanes if they want to get out of airplanes. So I'm going to vote for this, having made that statement. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further discussion? I'd like to put a small statement on the record. My reference to Caltrans is simply a little inside joke that I have with Representative Jensen. I appreciate Eastern Oregon communities so much more than their cows. And I support this measure because I'm a big supporter of rail and the efforts that we're trying to get to tie in Eastern Oregon into the Willamette Valley system. So I don't think we're going to do any harm by this. Okay, if there's no further discussion, I will ask clerk to call the roll.
Representative Devlin.
Aye.
Representative Hill.
Aye.
Representative Krupp.
Aye.
Representative Lee.
Aye.
Representative Wilkins.
No.
Representative Taylor.
Aye.
Representative Walker.
Aye.
Representative Lowe.
No.
Representative Montgomery.
Aye.
Okay, SAM 4 passes the committee with a two-pass recommendation. I need a carrier. Representative Cromwell, thank you very much. You'll be our carrier. Okay, I'll close the work session on SAM 4. And put my notes away. How'd you do all this stuff? Okay, well, open public hearing on Senate Bill 351. And we have John Miner and Kelly Taylor want to come up together? Great.
That is a sale. We get a state agency and a lucky account.
How lucky can we be?
Kind of scary.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Taylor with the Department of Transportation. This is another one of the concepts that was brought up by the employees of the department during the interim, and it was to streamline the process that we use for exempting manufactured structures from title and registration requirements. Most people don't know that if your manufactured structure is your personal property, in other words, like in a mobile home park or something like that, you don't own the land that it's on, it actually has a title like a car and we issue the license plate. But if it's part of property, then it has a deed filed with the county, just like a stick-built home. And what this bill is about is streamlining the process to tell the department, hey, my manufactured structure is on real property, so I'm not going to be title registering it. Just mark it in your records that it's exempt from the title registration, and I'll go on my way. And years ago, like when the program began in 1981, we only did about 20 a month. It was pretty small. But more and more, manufactured homes have gotten bigger and improved and everything, and people are interested in putting them on homes or land as their regular home. The volume's grown. And today we're doing about 250 a month. Just brand new, going straight to the land, okay? The exemption process is time-consuming for us and the customers. The people get bounced between the title and escrow companies and DMV filing paperwork and back and forth and everything. This idea is pretty simple. It says, listen, you're working with a lender, usually the bank on your loan in your home, and an escrow company, just like a stick-built home, and you're going to be filing a deed with the county, just like a stick-built home. When you get all of that process done, file some paperwork with certain information to the Department of Transportation, and we'll record it on our record so that the county and everybody knows that it's there and it exists and it's done. And that way, the customer doesn't get shuttled back and forth to DMV and waiting for paperwork to be looked through. So it will still serve as a central record keeper. And the change will save about one position, just equal to one position in the next biennium. The money you see in the fiscal, $66,000 or so in the first biennium and $76,000 in the second biennium, is tied to that position. On the Senate side, there was some concerns with the original language in the bill, and it was amended after I had a big work group. I pulled everybody together, all the lobbyists that had any piece of the process. I had escrow companies and banks and the manufacturer home folks, and everybody there. And not only the lobbyists were there, but they brought their clients, real people that do the work every day. And we sat around the table for 2 hours and worked it out. And by the time we got done, and everybody in the county were there, by the time we got done, everybody realized what we were trying to achieve. And that's why you have the Anne Gross version in front of you. This is language all worked out. Everybody's looked it over. And we could have done a big group hug by the time we were done. Everybody was really pleased with it. So, which doesn't always happen in those meetings. So, and with me today is John Miner, and he was in that meeting, and he represents the Oregon Manufactured Homes Association.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm John Miner, here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association. I think Kelly's described the bill very well. I don't have anything to add except that we support the bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Madam Chair. Representative Logan, and then Representative Wells.
I have a question, Dan. It sounds like everybody's happy with it, including the manufactured homeowners.
Madam Chair and Representative Logan, I would believe the owners would like this because they're not going to have to bounce back and forth to DMV anymore. Does it simply work with the title escrow company like they would have skipped those home? It helps save them time and money.
Follow up? Yes. You mean the fees are less, whatever fees they have to pay are less?
Madam Chair and Representative Logan, what happens currently is you do pay some fees when you're working with an escrow company for lot reports and everything, those are only good for a certain amount of time to show that nothing's changed with the lot. And as they're bouncing back and forth to DMZN trying to get paperwork reviewed and everything, sometimes those have expired and they've had to pay for another lot report. So this will save them money in that respect.
One more question.
Okay.
I see that we streamlined the workload equal to one position.
Mm-hmm.
How does that affect our real savings there?
Madam Chair and Representative Loken, this is part of one of the budget packages in our Ways and Means budget this year.
And that okay. actually reduces...
And they can choose to actually reduce
the employee position.
Yes, Representative Loken. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Wells.
Thank you. I have a manufactured home, and I have the license plate hanging up in the shed beside it, just signed it out there, because we went through this process. Maybe in a practical manner, you could go through the steps that currently you would go through if you were going down to a lot and buying a new manufactured home. And of course, as I understand, this bill really only affects people who are going to be moving on to private property. But currently, what steps are we saving so we can really understand what this is in practical terms? What would I go through if I was buying a manufactured home today, Don?
Madam Chair, Representative Wells, this bill won't change the steps that the consumer goes through as a practical matter. What this bill really does is that these transactions are almost always closed by a title or an escrow company. Under the current law, they send the paperwork to DMV, then DMV sends it to the county. Under this program, the title or escrow company will send it to the county and have it recorded and send it to DMV. So from the consumer's perspective, nothing changes.
I just want to qualify that. We do have customers that do shuttle the paperwork back and forth. So what happens is you go to the bank to get a loan, just like you would have fixed something to be approved. And then you go find the home that you'd like, and you work with the manufacturer dealer to purchase the home. And you're also probably at the same time either have land or purchasing land that you'd like to put it on. So you're working with a bank, a lot of times Washington Mutual, banks that loan a lot of times to manufacture homes, and you're working with a title company like Don said. And then he's right. The escrow company many, many times does the work for you, but we do have customers, either the escrow company or the actual owner, coming into DMV to submit the paperwork halfway through, showing the lot book and who's going to be, who was a lien holder and who's knows they're going on in the deed. And what's happening today is DMV in the middle of this process is proofreading the title company's paperwork and saying, yeah, it looks like it's in place or not, and then handing it back. And of course, if it's not, the person has to go back to try to, as I was saying to Representative Loken, go back to make it good. Now, the lot book report is only good by law for a certain amount of time because you don't know that anything's changing on those county records. And so sometimes the person has to start over with getting a fresh lot book report. So what we're trying to do is say, go ahead and go to the bank, get your loan set up, get your land set up, buy your manufactured home. When you work with the title company, they'll make sure all the liens and everything are taking place or being put on that deed because that's their responsibility. That's the part of escrow. And then they're going to be recording the deed with the county and at the same time filing the paperwork at DMV at the end of it. So what we're really doing is taking us out of the middle of proofreading the title and escrow company's paperwork.
Madam Chair.
Follow up?
I guess where I'm a little confused is I had my own property already. Like out there on my farm, and I'm going to put a manufactured home out there. Why did I get a title company in escrow? Can't I just go down to a manufactured home place and write a check and have them deliver that thing out there? Why am I involved with all these other people?
Madam Chair and Representative Wells, yes, you could if you were buying it outright. If you were paying cash for it, you could do that. That's why this bill says the owner or an attorney for the owner, because in the case where you're not buying it outright, just clunking it down in your own land, you're working with a title company usually, almost always. So either way, but you still, Representative Wells, would be required, since you're not going to be titling and registering it, you're not getting that plate to hang in your shed, you still would be required to tell the state, even under today's language, to tell us that you've exempted and put it on your own property.
Well, I did, yeah.
Right. So this is just streamlining that process.
Thank you, Richard Montgomery.
Very brief. You took the date out. There must have been a reason for that. Secondarily, the county, they go to the county clerks. The county clerks can charge a recording fee, and each county can charge different. Everybody's happy with that.
Madam Chair and Representative Montgomery. First, we took the date out because at first we were thinking there would be some programming changes, and we had a later operative date on it. We don't need that, so it'll be a 90-day bill. And second, yes, today you would pay a recording fee, and tomorrow you'd pay a recording fee. And yes, each county could be different.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, you won't be back next session saying all counties should be equal.
Madam Chair and Representative Montgomery, that wouldn't be for me to propose.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want it on the record because they will be.
Any further questions from the committee? All right, thank you.
Thank you.
I don't have anyone else here to sign up. Is anyone come in that would like to testify on Bill 351? All right, we'll close the public hearing and open the whole session. What's the pleasure of the committee?
President Hill. Move Senate Bill 351. President Gross to the floor for the detached recommendation.
Representative Hill moves Senate Bill 351 and Gross with the detached recommendation to the floor. Any discussion? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Representative Devlin.
Aye.
Representative Hill.
Aye.
Representative Krupp.
Aye.
Representative Crummel.
Aye.
Representative Neiman.
Aye.
Representative Logan.
Aye.
Representative Taylor.
Aye.
Representative Walker. Aye.
Representative
Wells.
Yes.
Representative Montgomery.
Aye.
Okay, thank you. Senate Bill 51 has amended. Goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Do I have a carrier? Representative Devlin, thank you very much. Okay. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 351 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 352. Do I have a sign of sheet? Okay. Okay. I realize I've been forgetting to ask the committee administrator to give us a report on these bills. And since Brad and Jan have traded places, Brad, do you want to give us a little update on this bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 352 comes to you at the request of the Department of Transportation and concerns two basically housekeeping provisions. The first affects trailer titles. Currently, out-of-state trailers in California required to register in California, and this creates a proportional registration situation for those trailers, allowing them to be exempted from titling requirements in Oregon. However, California is thinking about eliminating that registration requirement, and thus these trailers would only be registered in Oregon and thus be required to title in Oregon. Senate Bill 352 seeks to continue the exemption, grandfathering the existing trailers, and allowing that exemption to continue until those trailers die out. There are some representatives from the Oregon trucking industry and ODOT to explain that situation further. Second part of the bill exempts booster axles from safety chain requirements. Included in your packet is an example of a booster axle. I personally didn't know what that was, and there's also someone here from ODOT to explain what those are.
All right.
Thank you,
Madam Chair. Thank you. Why don't we have both the lobbyists for OTA, Lane Gower, I believe, and Steve Johnson with ODOT come up at the same time? Those are the only two people we have to testify. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Johnson. I'm manager of field services for ODOT's Motor Fair Transportation Division. I think the description of the two changes, especially the one regarding the titling exemption, were fairly clear, and I won't read my testimony since it has already gone over, but the impact on the titling of California is to change how they register their vehicles, their trailers, would result in approximately 18,000 trailers who would have to either get a title in Oregon or turn in their plates. These trailers are permanent registration, meaning they've got a one-time plate, they'll never get another plate. Oregon's received all of the registration fees they'll ever receive on these vehicles. As California changes, their regulations, what will happen is these trailers will no longer be considered proportional under the IRP, the proportional registration, which means that there'd be a lot of work for the motor carriers as well as DMV, and there's no revenue impact. The other piece is a requirement for booster axles to be chained under our current law. It requires vehicle combinations to be chained. A booster axle is used in the heavy haul industry, and it's either bolted or pinned to the trailer. No other state nor motor or federal motor carrier safety regulations require they be chained. They're virtually impossible to come off because of the way they're hooked on there. As a heavy haul carrier comes into the state of Oregon with a booster axle, it requires that they either put chains on or they get some type of exemption from us to basically say they don't need the chain. By eliminating the chaining requirements, the booster axles that are either pinned or bolted, they bring us in compliance with the rest of the states as well as in compliance with motor regulations, which do not feel that these are necessary. There is one slight defect in the bill, and what it talks about is if they change the jurisdiction regarding titling, and that should be changed to proportional registration, and that's online. On line 14 on page 3, it says exception to the title requirements for the trailer. It should say the proportional registration requirements for the trailer.
So take out exception to title requirements?
Madam Chair, Representative Crumble, what they should do is they should say the exception to the, and then to, and take out the word title and change it to proportional registration requirements.
Proportional?
So, proportional registration should replace the word title.
And that's on page 3, line?
Line 14.
Line 14.
I'm sure that I can close my question.
All right, thank you. Representative Wells.
Thank you. Steve, I thought I knew a lot about this whole issue, but I have to admit I really don't understand what we're talking about here. So we go back to basic 101.
Mr.
Explain how trailers are registered in Oregon and really what we're talking about here.
And hold that thought for just a moment. Representative Crooks, did you have something germane to this question?
Yes.
Okay. That is it.
In regards to chains, are you talking about when they come across the hill and at Siskiyou's and they need to put chains on the trailers to keep the trailer from coming around and kissing the cab?
Madam Chair, Representative Crock, no, we're talking about the safety chains if the two vehicles were to separate, the vehicles would be chained together.
Okay. I apologize. I thought that was where Representative Wells was heading with that question.
Okay, so you as Representative Wells,
then. What I'm interested in is, currently we're not talking about the trucks, we're talking about trailers. Oregon has a permanent trailer registration, $10, I think, permanent registration, is that true?
Madam Chair, Representative Wells, it's either $10 or $14.
The permanent registration, it's on trailers all the time.
Yes, sir.
So now how does this affect these trailers with California? Is that what we're talking about now?
Madam Chair, Representative Wells, yes, it is. What happens is, under the law, you have to have, in order to register a vehicle in the state, you need the title. It has to be titled here.
We're talking about the trailer. These trailers.
The trailer only, sir.
These trailers that are sitting all around the country, and they hook onto them and drop them and whatever. They're just a flash registration is on them. And they're titled in Oregon, is what you say.
Madam Chair, Representative Wells, the problem is they're not titled in Oregon. They're titled in California. And under Oregon law, you can only register a vehicle if it's titled here, except for the exemption that says unless you're allowed to you're allowed to do it if you are a member of the registration plan, and the registration plan allows it. California is about to change how they register or how they title their trailers. And what will happen is if they make this change, then approximately 18,000 trailers, which are registered in Oregon, but do not have title in Oregon, will be required to either obtain an Oregon title, or they would be required to surrender their plate. What this bill does is says, if exemption happens, these trailers will be grandfathered, because what will happen is no more new trailers will be allowed to be registered unless they have a title. But we have the problem of the 18,000 that are on the books, and the hope would be is that they would die a natural attrition and they'd go off of the books. And there's no revenue impact because the trailers paid a one-time permanent registration fee.
Hey, Madam Chair, if they're titled in California, why are they registered in Oregon? Why don't they have a California registration plate on it? Or we have a proportion plate or something. Somebody in California owns these, but they're registered in Oregon with an Oregon permit plate. Why that?
Madam Chair, Representative Wells, I can't really tell you that because I'm not in the motor carrier industry, but the motor carrier industry is right beside me. You should probably respond why they would do that.
Madam Chair, Representative Wells, for the record, my name is Lanny Gower. I'm with CNF Transportation. I'm here today to testify in favor of this bill for OTA's Government Affairs Committee. Madam Chair, Representative Wells, regarding your question on why they would title in, say, California and then be registered in Oregon. To clarify it a little bit, it's not just in California. The current exemption in Oregon law allows any trailer covered by Oregon apportionment registration to be exempt from Oregon title requirements. It could be titled anywhere in the country, not just California. The reason that can happen is carriers have different title requirements on trailers or different states they purchase the trailers in. If we buy 300 trailers in the state of Illinois, for instance, but they're going to be nationwide trailers, we're an Oregon-based carrier, so they would go on our Oregon interstate fleet, those 300 trailers. However, the bank we work with where we purchase them in Illinois, maybe a local bank with lawyers that are familiar with Illinois security interests and title laws, and they're very comfortable with titles in the state of Illinois. So originally those trailers might be titled with Illinois and have a lien with that particular bank. When we put those on our interstate fleet in Oregon, we'd pay a $10 title fee if we had to title them here. Also, there's no revenue for the state of Oregon because that's what it costs DMV to issue the title. However, it would require us to change paperwork over, the bank to change paperwork over, and DMV to handle the titles for no apparent purpose. The exemption from that title requirement currently has been in effect, I believe, since I've been involved with this issue for 15 years. All this bill does is the current exemption, the language in the exemption says apportioned trailers are exempt because they're interstate vehicles. California is the last state that requires trailers to be apportioned. All other states, Oregon did this, I believe, 12 years ago, took all the registration fees basically off the trailers and eliminated the need to apportion them. So once California changed their laws to eliminate the need to apportion trailers, Oregon's exemption, there's no definition of an apportioned trailer because they don't exist. What this does is take those trailers that have had that exemption for the last 20 years and grandfather that exemption on so that all of these trailers don't have to go out and get their paperwork from 50 others or 49 other states and transfer them in over for no revenue increase to the state and no benefit to the motor carrier industry.
Question, Representative Taylor?
Just a comment, Madam Chair. I'd just like to tell you that I think we have an opportunity here to do a good thing. And as a former legislative assignment, I spent two sessions assigned to the Pacific Northwest Economic Region Council. And there we were told that the West would never have been settled as it was by rail, essentially, if we'd not gone to the same gauge railroad between states. But we put up these barriers for our trucking industry between states that causes them to have to stop at the state line, put an unneeded safety chain on a trailer, for instance. And so I think that, according to my nephew, who's a long-haul truck driver, it's just a headache from one state to the next to figure out what these regulations are going to be as they come in across our border. So wherever we can do this kind of thing to make it easier for the industry, I think, without sacrificing safety or revenue, we have a good opportunity here.
Thank you. Any further questions or comments? Okay. Thanks, Norman.
Yep.
I don't have anyone else signed up, so we'll close the public hearing and open the work session on Bill 362. Representative Bill.
Madam Chair, move to suspend the rules for the purpose of making a conceptual amendment to Senate Bill 352.
Representative Hill makes a motion to suspend the rules to make a conceptual amendment to Senate Bill 352, and is there any opposition to that? Okay, Representative Hill, state your amendment.
Move to amend Senate Bill 352 conceptually on line 14, page 3, remove the word title, and insert proportional registration.
Okay, Representative Hill made a motion to remove the word title on line 14 and replace it with proportional registration. Is there any discussion or objection to that? Okay. Then the amendment is accepted. Is that what we do? Okay. The amendment, the conceptual amendment is approved. Okay. Mr. Johnson, could you come forward? We have a question for you. Related to language, are we talking proportional or apportional?
Apportioned. Because I'm just my mouth misspoke.
Okay. Here. Spell the word.
I spelled in the
apportioned registration. Apportioned registration.
APPP.
That's what I'm thinking, but I just wanted to spell it to make sure we're hearing the right word.
Proportional is fine. No, you're saying correct. Proportional is fine.
Proportional.
P-R-O-P-O-R-I-O-N-A-S.
All right, so we're fine. Tell me about it. It appears that the current amendment will stand. Representative Hill.
I'm Chairman Smith Bill 52 as a special amendment to the floor of the Dispatch Recommendation.
Okay. Representative Hill proposes to remove Senate Bill 352 to the floor as conceptually amended with a Dispatch Recommendation. Any discussion? Okay, thanks. Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Hill? Aye.
Representative Rogan?
Aye.
Representative Taylor?
Aye.
Representative Wells?
Yes.
Representative Montgomery?
Aye.
All right, thank you. Senate Bill 352 passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended, conceptually amended. Do I have a carrier? Representative Lehman does. I thought maybe Representative Wells, since he's got a full understanding of it.
Yeah, that's why I want a carrier.
All right, well, Representative Lehman is our carrier, and that closes the work session, and we don't have any further business before the committee today, so we're adjourned.
I think somebody that can talk fast. Just put that in the mouth. Never ask any questions.